So I gave an introduction to Mathematica, beginning and more advanced features on the past 2 days. And today I want to talk about how to solve differential equations with Mathematica using numerical methods. I think this ties nicely with the Green's functions course. The Green's functions is the inverse of a differential operator. So if you can calculate the Green's functions, you can solve a differential equation. And you can also do that numerically. It's typically not called Green's functions. One would rather use words such as discretization and so on. But it is the same thing. It means you evaluate the Green's function for one particular argument, for a particular set of boundary conditions and right-hand sides. And I want to present that. This is a very large field called numerical analysis. And as I mentioned, probably on the first day, if you take a year-long course, that year-long course would be called Introduction to Numerical Methods. So today, I'm just going to give you a brief glimpse. And it's going to be heavy on Mathematica because we're going to use Mathematica. I'm going to use really simple examples that we can actually go through them, but we are not held up by the actual techniques, but rather only held up by implementing that in Mathematica. I'm going to present two different methods, and then you maybe see some commonalities between the methods. And if you're going to use numerical methods at a later point to solve differential equations, then maybe that rings a bell and you have a general feeling for how this is done. And then, of course, numerical methods exist in many different fields as well. For example, linear algebra, tensor multiplications, matrices, eigenvalues, and so on, quantum mechanics. It's really important there. I'm not going to describe that today. Today, I'm concentrating on solving differential equations. You probably know that if you want to solve a differential equation exactly, then it's hit and miss. If it has a very particular structure, then you can do that. There are a few algorithms that you can employ, separation of variables, and so on. But most of the times, if you find a generic partial differential equation, you're out of luck solving it exactly. Numerical methods are very advanced, and they can often give an answer, even if exact methods do not work. Today, I'm going to use a simple example of just the linear differential equations in one dimension, an ordinary differential equation, that is. But the methods that I'm going to show generalize nicely to much more complicated cases, multiple variables, nonlinear equations, and partial differential equations of many variables. Okay. Of course, anytime you have questions, either on the physics that you're doing, well, more the mathematics, or what I'm presenting here, feel free to interrupt and ask. The basic idea, if you solve a differential equation, that then the question you're asking is you're looking for a function that solves that particular differential equation. And the basic question that you have to ask yourself is, how can I represent that function? Functions can look like anything. It's very difficult to represent them. And one method to do that would be to use orthogonal polynomials. You project your solution onto orthogonal polynomials that works if the function is analytic or can be represented like that. And then we're going to cut off after a certain number of coefficients. That is, we take this infinite dimensional vector space, and we just look at a particular subspace of that with finitely many dimensions. And that's then called a discretization, because you have a finite, a discrete number of coefficients to represent that function. And today I'm going to use whatever, 4 or 5 different coefficients. Of course, computers are really good at these things. In the real world, you can use billions of coefficients to represent a function. And then rather complex-looking functions can be approximated rather accurately. There's basically no limit to that except computing power. So to make things simple, I'm going to look to use a domain of -1 to +1, just a one-dimensional interval on which I'm looking for a solution. And since I want to use orthogonal polynomials, the question is, what kind of orthogonal polynomials are appropriate for that domain? You probably know, if you know the domain and where your singularities are, there is one particular kind of polynomials that are useful for that. If it goes, the domain goes from 0 to infinity, then it's probably something like Bessel functions. If your domain is infinitely large, it's probably Fourier polynomials or something, but sine, cosine, exponential. And for -1 to +1 is the Legendre functions or the Chebyshev functions. Going to use Legendre functions here. They are slightly easier to use. And let's look at them. I assume you all know that, but let's just revisit that. So the Mathematica command, you should all understand. Legendre P is the Legendre polynomial. I is the index, goes from 0 to infinity. And X is the x-coordinate. And we put them in a table from 0 to 4. That gives us 5 polynomials. And we plot that on that interval. And then we see how they look like. and that's the zeroth polynomial, it's the constant 1. Then there's a linear function, there's a quadratic function here, there's this S-shaped thingy, the third order, and the fourth order is the W-shaped one, and so on. And if you were to use Chebyshev polynomials instead, then they would look very similar, except all the maxima and minima at plus 1 and minus 1. And let's define a dot product between two of them. This dot product has two functions, well, the expressions f and g in a variable x. We just integrate from minus 1 to plus 1. If you input it, you would write it like this. But if you write it like this, it looks nicer. That's just the dot product. And let's just calculate the dot product between 0 and 4 for all the polynomials. And see they're indeed orthogonal, but they're not normalized. The diagonal has entries that are not 1 because they're normalization coefficients you have to take into account.
Are we talking about Legendre or Chebyshev?
This is Legendre. You see that I write Legendre P in there.
And you've written about the Chebyshev polynomials have a weight.
Yes. If you define your dot product, this integral here, for Chebyshev polynomials, then the dot product needs to look different. For Chebyshev polynomials, you need to have a weight function in there, which is something like square root of 1 over 1 minus x squared or something in there.
And
you have to choose the right dot product, because otherwise the polynomials are not orthogonal. They're orthogonal with respect to that dot product.
And you had been using the same dot product for the Legendre?
This is the dot product I'm using. That's the correct one for the Legendre polynomials.
Okay.
This is the function I'm defining, and I'm using it here. And with respect to that dot product, they are orthogonal. So another function that is useful to have, of course, is to expand a particular function into Legendre polynomials. So let's define that function here. So we just calculate the dot product of that function with a Legendre polynomial. We divide by the dot product of the Legendre polynomials with itself to get the normalization factor out. We run that in a table from I to n, n is an input to that function, and then we give the expansion coefficients from 0 to n of that particular function. Just a nice thing to have. And this is the converse to that. We can reconstruct a function if we have the coefficients. Cs are the coefficients. We just take the coefficients, index plus 1, since array indices start at 1, coefficients start at 0. We multiply it with respect to Legendre polynomial. And length of Cs is just the approximation order here. And we sum that all up. And then we reconstruct the function like that. I mean, it's just a standard way. Just writing it in Mathematica, let's take a function, for example, cosinus of pi, and let's calculate the first four coefficients. And as you see, the odd coefficients are all 0. You'd expect that because cosine is an even function. And these are the first, and this is the fourth coefficient. Mathematica did all that exactly. So all the integrals here and so on are evaluated exactly, not numerically. That's a bit slow. If you have really complicated functions, expressions, you may want to evaluate that numerically instead. Then you get a number, whatever, 15 digits or something here, not the exact expression. I'm going to leave that here to show off Mathematica's capabilities. If you reconstruct the function of these coefficients, that's the function that we are getting. And let's plot these things. We're expanding the cosine function. That's the blue one here. Expansion order 0 gives us that line here. Of course, zeroth order expansion is rather inaccurate. A second order expansion gives us that yellow line here, the parabola. It kind of begins to capture the spirit of a cosine function, but is far off. And a fourth order expansion is the green line here. It's still different from the blue line. There's also some wiggles here at the side, but it gets more accurate. And of course, if you increase the expansion order, things become more and more accurate. Oui. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to use this mechanism, expanding something, and then solve for the coefficients. This is how I'm going to solve a particular differential equation. As the differential equation, I'm going to choose a rather simple equation, just the Poisson equation. You're probably familiar with that. Let me just write it down. Should I maybe not? No, it's probably written down anyway. It's easier to read on the screen, I think. The Poisson equation with a particular right-hand side. The Poisson equation describes things like, Newtonian gravity, or electromagnetic potential, electric potential, or other things with curvature, for example, shape of soap bubbles and so on. And on the right-hand side, I want to use something a bit more complicated. I would like to use something like a point charge, a point particle, a Dirac delta distribution, but that doesn't really work well with numerical methods. You want something smooth, so I'm going to smooth it out. And the way I'm going to smooth it out, I'm going to try two different methods. First is a top hat function. A top hat function is zero everywhere, except in a small interval where it's non-zero. And if you integrate this top hat function, the integral is 1, as it should be. And another approximation for a Dirac delta distribution, I'm going to use a Gaussian, which also has the right normalization, as you see here. And if you plot these two, this is how they look like. This is our domain, 1 and minus 1. Top hat function is 0, except for a particular thing. Looks like a top hat, and this is a Gaussian thing. And they all both have a parameter w. If you make w smaller, they get more narrow and more peaked, approximating Dirac delta. This is the right-hand side that I'm going to use for the differential equation. And the differential equation itself looks like this. It's just the second derivative. The equation just is that the second derivative of a function minus the Gaussian or something else, the top-hat function, is supposed to be 0. I leave out the something equals 0 because that makes some steps easier in the end, because then I just have a term that can be evaluated instead of an equation. Okay. So far, I hear mostly silence from you. Most of this, of course, the physics background should be rather trivial, should be all familiar to you. But the Mathematica implementation, do you have questions regarding this, regarding the choices, the syntax? Probably not. Then I'm going to consider, must not forget to press enter here. Thank you. I'm going to consider two kinds of boundary conditions. First, in the easier case, Dirichlet boundary conditions, where I just set something to 0. Let me just fix that here. So for the boundary conditions, I define a function that takes as input the value at the boundary, the value of the derivative at the boundary, and the location of the boundary. And I just require that the function value should be 0. That's a Dirichlet boundary condition. And using the same notation, I avoid and don't write the equals to 0. There are two boundary conditions. I put them in a list at minus 1, then at plus 1. Now I'm going to cheat. I'm going to ask Mathematica to solve the equation. Later on, I'm going to use the numerical method. Then I can compare things. Otherwise, it's difficult to judge whether a method works. Whenever you write something new, you want to start with something where you already know the solution. Then you try the new method out and see whether you can get that solution that you already know. And then once you've validated a method, of course, then you go on and apply them to more complicated things where Mathematica, say, couldn't solve it. So let's ask Mathematica. Mathematica says this is the particular solution. It looks a bit complicated with fourth and sixteenths in there because the width of the Gaussian that I chose is 4. That's where the numbers 4 and 16 pop up. I pick the first solution. And you see the solution here. It's presented in terms of a rule. F of x goes to something. So write f of x, and then use pattern replacement to apply that rule. And this is then my solution. Then looks like this. And if I plot the solution, this is how it looks like. Unsurprisingly, out here, where the source is 0, curvature of the function is 0. That's what it means. F double prime is 0. And in here, you have a parabolic thing that, for example, corresponds to the gravitational field that you would find in a planet if things were one-dimensional and not three-dimensional. Three dimensions, of course, outside. It's not linear. You get 1 over r outside. But for 1D, that's the correct solution. And you notice that I did not assign something to f of x, which you may be tempted to do. Because once you assign something to f of x, then you would make it difficult to go back up again and write down the equation. And at this point, it may seem a bit abstract, but I think it's important. Let's do it anyway. Here, when I'm writing the equations, I'm using f of x. If you have a solution one is tempted to write f of x equals and define the solution that way, but then you can't use the equation anymore. I'm not explaining that very well. So I have here a solution, and the solution is just an expression. You may be tempted to write f of x equals msol, and then f is solution, it's a function that you can plot. And that would be something convenient to do. But if you do this, then you give a value to f, and if you look at the equation later on and reevaluated this up here, then it suddenly looks very different, because now f is not a generic function for which you have a condition, f is now a specific thing, and that is a bad idea. One of you nods, that's good. You can explain it to the others if my explanation was not very good. And let's get rid of this here.
Sorry, can I just ask about the syntax of the diesel that you use?
Yes.
You've got...
So I have the equation here and the boundary conditions, yep. And I just put them together in a list. That's this one here. Now, the equation is just one condition, and the boundary conditions is two. So you have a list of a list in there. I don't like that. So I put flatten around that. And then I have a single list with three elements, the equation and two boundary conditions.
And
now, the conditions that I chose, I wrote that just as terms, not if something equals zero. Dsolve doesn't like that. So I have to add the equals zero to all the terms in the list. And this here is a map function. And this is a function that takes any input, and the output is that same thing equals zero. And this maps this over the list. And for example, if I have a list A, B, C, and then I map something equals zero over this list, then I get all these things equals zero.
Thanks.
So this is the complication that I got for not writing things as equations, but just as terms that are supposed to be zero. But for the numerical method later on, the syntax I chose will make things easier. OK, so far, it's all mathematical, and all seems well. And you still may ask yourself, why actually bother with the numerical solution? So let's now begin. First, I choose how many expansion coefficients to use. Of course, to get an exact solution, you have to use infinitely many, but obviously that won't work in an algorithm. So say I choose 4 just to keep the number small. In real world, you may want to use something larger, 8, 10, or 20 or something. But 20 is already quite large for projecting onto orthogonal polynomials. They get very accurate very quickly. And if you go up to order 20, then you may need an accuracy of whatever 10 or 20 digits to actually get all the coefficients correct. So you have to be careful there. Let's just use order 4 here. And our ansatz for representing the solution is just a set of coefficients, C0 to C4. And if we reconstruct the function from these coefficients, then this is the function. It's a fourth order polynomial, as expected. And there are these 5 coefficients in there. And what we now need to do, we need to determine these coefficients. So what we now do is we plug in our function into the boundary conditions and into the equations. So if you plug it into the boundary conditions, it looks like that. Right? All the Legendre polynomials are either 1 or 0, 1 at the boundary. So this makes sense with the alternating sum for the boundary conditions. And if you plug it in the equation, you get something like this. And we now need to solve this. We now need to solve this for the coefficients. Now, this is not supposed to be 0. So the basic idea is now that we take this equation and we again project it onto the particular subspace that we have. We again project that onto our polynomial basis. And then we can get conditions for the individual coefficients. Let's do this for the zeroth order polynomial function, just as an example here. And that then would like this. So one of the conditions that we have is that this expression is supposed to be 0. solving this equation up here, I mean, it's an equation, if you write equals zero for the coefficients, is complicated because it contains both the coefficients and it also dependent on x. If you project it onto the particular subspace, then the dependence on x will vanish because it's integrated out. And you see here, this is, if you project it onto the constant space, onto the zeroth Legendre polynomial, this does not depend on x anymore. This is just the condition for C2 and C4. This is just the error function, just something that can be evaluated to arbitrary accuracy. And if we do that with the other terms as well, then we get a few more coefficient conditions. Hello? Takes a bit, I guess. I hope I didn't forget to define something. Yes, so we're getting a set of conditions for all the coefficients. And since it's a linear differential equations, these are all linear conditions for all the coefficients that we have here. For example, C3, since 15 C3 is equal to 0, C3 is 0, we expect that because everything is even order here, and so on and so forth. You notice that the last two conditions that we are getting, this one and this one in, are different because they don't contain any of these coefficients here. This one equals 0 makes sense. This one equals 0 is a condition that can't be satisfied because this one is just a number if you evaluate it, and it's not 0. And what happens here is that when we make the cutoff in our approximation at the highest order, then, of course, the cutoff is artificial. We introduce an inconsistency there. All the higher coefficients, C5, C6, and so on, we drop them. They would be appearing here, but they don't appear because we left them out. So we have to actually drop the last two coefficients here. And that means we have three equations for five coefficients. That's an underdetermined system. At the same time, we have two boundary conditions, so that makes up for it. And that is also, in this case, a nice example of why you need two boundary conditions for a second order equation, because you kind of lose two of the highest order terms, and then you make it up by two boundary conditions. A first order differential equation, you'd only need to apply one condition, and if you have a fifth order equation, you need to supply five additional coefficients. So we take the conditions, we just take a subset of the conditions. They go from, they're numbered from 1 to order plus 1. We drop the two highest conditions. We set them to 0. We add the boundary conditions, replace our unsets in there, and then we solve it. This is not just an algebraic solve for the conditions. It's even a linear solve. So there are generic algorithms that can do that. I'm just being lazy by typing it like this. Get the solution, various solutions. Pick one of the solutions. If you look, write it out numerically, these are the coefficients that we got from our ansatz. And if you plot the result, it looks like this. One of these is Mathematica's solution. The other one is ours. I think the blue one is Mathematica's solution with a nice straight line. Our ansatz is a bit more wiggly here. We are getting close enough. This is with fourth order. If you increase the order, sixth order, and so on, you would get a much more accurate solution. Okay, I understand that this is a bit abstract and a bit overwhelming in the end. And since Mathematica is nicely able to solve the simple equation, there may not be much point in doing that. So let me repeat the exercise, but make it slightly more complicated. Let's, for example, use the top hat function instead of the Gaussian here. I think you all understand the definition of the top hat function. If the absolute value of x is less than 1/4, you get this value of 2, otherwise 0. Let's redefine our equation. I'm just going through the Mathematica notebook again. Where is it? Oh, no, I already redefined the equation. Differential solve. Let's take the equation. Let's plot the solution. And this looks a bit strange. Can you tell me what's strange about this solution? V We have a second order differential equation, and the right hand side is discontinuous. And that means the function itself should be discontinuous twice integrated, so it should be once differentiable, C1. And the solution that Mathematica spits out is clearly not continuous. Mathematica suggests a solution that everything is zero, and then at 1/4, where the topic function, there's actually a jump, then the parabolic piece, another jump, and everything is zero again. And that is clearly not the solution that we wanted. Something is very wrong here. We had a discontinuity in our equation, and Mathematica takes this as opportunity to give us a discontinuous solution. In other words, Mathematica doesn't realize there's enough, there's freedom in the equations. We are giving two boundary conditions, and Mathematica uses the boundary conditions to set the boundary values to zero. Since it's a second order differential equation, you have kind of 2 degrees of freedom in each of the three pieces that make up the solution. You can have a constant and the linear part. So altogether, there are 6 degrees of freedom, 6 constants that one has in the solution. 2 of the constants are, of course, fixed by the boundary conditions. And at each of these 2 junctions, one would like to use 2 more conditions to ensure that things are continuous and differentiable across the junctions. But Mathematica doesn't do that for some reason. It doesn't realize that. And that, I also want to show, is a real danger of using a black box like Mathematica for this. It spits out something, and I mean, it kind of looks correct, and it's correct everywhere except at the junction conditions here, where you expect something continuous and differentiable, but what Mathematica outputs is not. So if you do something in Mathematica, it is never a good idea to just blindly trust the black box. You always want to do kind of 3 different inputs. You do it yourself on a piece of paper. You ask Mathematica, and you ask a colleague, or do something similar. You have to be very careful. There are also other cases where Mathematica, where some algorithms in there, simply contain errors. I mean, this just happens. Some integral is solved, and Mathematica gets something wrong. So this I found rather disappointing from Mathematica. And if we continue to use our own home-cooked numerical method for that, then, of course, things work nicely. If we plug in the boundary conditions in our numerical mod, the equation now looks different. If we continue and get the new conditions for this new right-hand side, that takes a bit again. Get solutions.
One question, sir.
Just a second. I just want to plot the solution. And here you see the real solution that we are getting from our numerical method. You see it's very similar to the solution we got previously, which is to be expected because the right-hand side was very similar. In both cases, it's kind of an approximation of a Dirac delta. The solutions look similar. And this up here, this is Mathematica's suggestion for a solution where something about the continuity there was not right. So I'm sure that can be fixed. Maybe there's a magic parameter to desolve that you tell it to expect things, the solution to be continuous and differentiable. Or I don't know, maybe Mathematica solves it assuming that x is a complex number and the function is holomorphic. And maybe if you tell it that x is real, it would work or something. I mean, there could be something. But at first sight, it's wrong. And I haven't looked at the documentation. So maybe you can fix it. Yes, you had a question?
Yeah. When you define this ENSOL, the numerical solution, I think I saw like a hash 1. What's
yes.
the difference between hash 1 and just hash?
If you have a function with a single argument, an anonymous function, it's just hash. If you have multiple arguments, then you have the number them. Then it's hash 1, hash 2, hash 3.
Okay.
So hash is the same as hash 1. It's just a shortcut if you have only one anonymous function.
Okay.
So if I input something, I always write hash. But internally, Mathematica always says hash 1. Where was that? Here, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, probably switched between input form and something else, and then Mathematica turned that into hash 1 automatically. Okay, so let's briefly recap the steps that we took here to solve the differential equation. First, you make an ansatz for a function. In this case, the ansatz was that we use an orthogonal polynomials as a basis and then just choose a few coefficients. And the important part is that we make a cutoff in the ansatz. You always have to do that in numerical methods because you can't handle infinitely many coefficients. You can only do that if you do something symbolically. And in this case, we cut off at 4. I mean, it doesn't matter. You can cut off at other pieces. And then the boundary conditions and the equations are rewritten in terms of this ansatz. And there are then conditions on the coefficients that we chose. And this is written down here. These are the coefficients. And this is the right-hand side. And this is the function that we plug in that now just depends on x and x squared. It's just the Legendre polynomials written out explicitly. And the various coefficients apply in here. And now we need to turn that into a set of equations for the coefficients, right? This is only one equation, but it still contains x. Now we turn that into a set of algebraic equations that does not depend on x anymore. And we do that in this case by just projecting onto the orthogonal basis again that we do that. And then we get particular conditions. Where was that? No, it was further up here. Yes, this was the set of conditions that we... Oh, yes, it looks different because now I have a different right-hand side than earlier. This is the set of conditions that we have onto the conditions. And you see it doesn't depend on x anymore. Similar conditions for the boundary condition. That is, I don't know, that was already listed further up. And then we just solve for these coefficients. In this case, everything is linear. The solving is easy. If things are nonlinear, then it's not as easy. Now, all the things that I do, they're kind of ad hoc. The many different numerical methods, they make different choices for something. And also in this calculation, many steps are performed symbolically because Mathematica can do that. If you're interested in speed and if you want to solve problems repeatedly, then of course you do the symbolic manipulation once ahead of time and later the actual projection onto a basis. You don't have symbolic functions anymore. For example, now here it's fine, but there was an if statement here or an error function or something, you would get rid of that earlier. And then you can get the solution, and you can basically get it to an arbitrary accuracy with these functions. And of course, this also works in multiple dimensions. You just need to make a different ansatz. For example, the tensor product ansatz, Legendre x times Legendre y, and then you have coefficients, not ci, but cij, and so on. And that, of course, is very convenient. If you try to solve a multidimensional partial differential equation exactly, that costs you a lot of headache, whereas here, it's a straightforward method. I want to show you a different numerical method as well, where we don't use orthogonal polynomials, just to show you the breadth of the field of numerical analysis. And sometimes orthogonal basis functions are easier to use, and sometimes something like this is easier to use. So we make a different ansatz for the function. Basic idea is the same. We have a function, you make an ansatz, we have coefficients, and we solve for the coefficients. But the ansatz here, we choose piecewise polynomial functions, or piecewise linear functions, in this case, polynomials. So since we have various pieces, we just choose where the pieces lie, where the junctions should be. For example, if we want to have 4 polynomials, we can choose the junctions like this. If we expand something, then previously we had this dot product, the integrals projecting onto the basis functions. For piecewise polynomials, we can also just sample it at the particular junction points. That is much simpler. We just evaluate the function at this point. Yeah, this is again a bit of mathematical magic here. These are the locations, for example, up here. And then we map a function here. We take these functions, and x gets replaced by, well, whatever the function argument is, namely the locations here. And as an example, this would then look like this, which is exactly what you want. And to reconstruct, you want to interpolate, right? You want something piecewise polynomial. Of course, I could have written linear interpolation out myself and so on, but it's easier to use Mathematica's interpolate function. So we pass in the locations that we have and the coefficients. The interpolation wants not two lists, but the lists of two elements each. So we need to transpose it. we choose interpolation order to 3. You can also use set it to 1 for linear interpolation or arbitrarily high interpolation, and the variable should be x. And then if we apply this, for example, to cosine pi again, then the result is this. This is our expansion. We just sample cosine pi at 4 points above. And of course, the values are just 0, plus 1, and minus 1 for the cosine function. It looks rather boring. And if you plot it, then it looks like this. So we have piecewise third-order polynomials. And the junctions are here, 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 and here. And of course, if you have just a single, for the highest order, if you have no junctions at all, then this is the function that you're getting. And as you add more points, I chose 1, 2, 4, 8 points. Well, 1, 2, 4, 8 pieces. There's always one more point than pieces. Then the function looks more and more accurate. There's here's a parabola that you're getting. And the highest order, if you have 8 different pieces, it's basically indistinguishable from the actual cosine function. You see the line is a bit thicker here because it actually overlaps it. And in many ways, a piecewise polynomial ansatz is much, much faster because you don't have a what is called a global method. If you have you need to project onto basis, then you for each of the coefficients you need to integrate from 0 to 1. That is, the function value at each of the points is a sum that involves all the coefficients. Whereas here, if you interpolate, you only need neighboring points, and then it would be easily possible to use hundreds or thousands of different pieces. And the pieces are basically independent of each other. So this is useful if you, if you need functions that vary wildly. I wanted to give you a task this afternoon. Try to represent, say, the function cosine of 10 pi via Legendre polynomials. And then you can estimate how many basis functions do you need to do that. That is actually independent of discretization numerical solving PDEs. So can you guess how many basis functions you would need to represent the function cosine 10 pi? The Legendre polynomials. So forgot to mention that earlier. So cosine 10 pi, of course, is a function that just wiggles very quickly. And in the interval 0 to plus 1, it has 10 or 20 wiggles on it, depending on how you count.
You mean like cosine 10 pi?
Yes. Haha. Oof, oof. Thank you. Very good. You understand the problem. So let's look at the function. It looks like this. And if you want to represent that with Legendre polynomials, then of course you need to have a basis that kind of captures at least the essence of the function. And if I plot at the same time, for example, the fourth Legendre polynomial, you see it doesn't oscillate far enough. It can't capture the essence of the function. And if we like the 10th order Legendre polynomial, still not 20. And now maybe with 20th order, you have enough oscillations in there. But you probably need to go to 40th order or something to do that. And that means if you have a function that varies very quickly, like cosine 10 pi x, you need to use an incredibly high order to represent that function. And if you use a piecewise polynomial ansatz, you can just take 100 different pieces, and each of these pieces could be even piecewise linear, and that would already work. Okay, so this was this representing a function with piecewise and the piecewise polynomial ansatz, and now we solve it, and the solution actually looks very similar than what we do before with coefficients, boundary conditions. And can plot the solution. What happened here? Okay, let me quit my kernel. This looks a bit strange. And evaluate the notebook again. Maybe I made a strange definition at some point. Nope, still that. Very strange. Okay, this is not how it looked yesterday when I wrote the notebook. Sorry. Maybe I need to use more pieces to make it look better. Yeah, that kind of works, I guess. Huh. Something wrong with the polynomial order? Yeah, maybe. Okay. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I typed something here. But you see that I'm plotting three solutions here. This is Mathematica's. Well, we should disregard that because it's wrong. This is the solution that comes from the other numerical method that I used before, projection under orthogonal basis, and then the one by using a piecewise polynomial ansatz. I was hoping they would agree better, but something is off. I don't know why at the moment. That's the danger when I do this. Something I wanted to demonstrate and that you maybe remembered, when I projected onto the polynomial basis further above, that took a second. The notebook was kind of freezing because that was this complicated expression that Mathematica needed to solve. Well, you can speed it up, but that's still the case that this is a rather slow operation, even though the order was only 4. And here now I'm using 160 different polynomial pieces, and it still works rather nicely. So this method is in a sense, much faster. Okay. So I think I didn't get much feedback to you today compared to yesterday and the day before. So I think I must have either overwhelmed you or gotten off on the wrong foot, or maybe you're not interested, or there was a party yesterday or so. But I'd like to get some feedback from you on this method. Did you understand the basics? Would you feel comfortable repeating that on your own? I mean, if I gave you this notebook this afternoon, would you feel comfortable making changes to it, say change the boundary condition or modify it to use Chebyshev polynomials instead or do something else? Or maybe if you're a Mathematica expert, try to speed it up a bit by making some calculations slightly faster.
I think it would be easier to follow if is there an option of seeing, like, having the thing before the lecture?
Pardon?
Like, having the notebook before the lecture, and then we can...
Yes, good. So I was hoping it would be easier if we developed things together in class. But, I still don't have access to the wiki. So also the things I showed you yesterday are not on the wiki yet, yes. But, that's a good point. I can post it before that. Before the lecture, then you can follow on all of the things yourself. Very good. Okay, since I don't know exactly what you understood and didn't understand, and since some of these points are actually relevant, I'd like to go through that again with a different kind of boundary condition, the Robin boundary condition. And go through the example step by step again, in the hope that I don't bore you, since that you're not silent, simply because you already understand everything. So a Dirichlet boundary condition sets everything to 0. A Robin boundary condition, in a certain sense, enforces a 1 over R fall off to a function, but does so at a particular finite location. The idea being, and I want to use the blackboard maybe, that you have a function you expect it to fall off as 1 over R, and you want to impose that as a boundary condition. Of course, if you impose that boundary condition at infinity, then you know that a function is going to be 0 at infinity, and that is nice. But if you want to impose that boundary condition at a finite location, that is more complicated, since you do not know what value the function should have there. So a function that falls off as 1 over R, of course, it looks generally like this, but if you write it f of r equals, well, it's something like a over r with some amplitude a, but you don't know the amplitude a because that is part of the solution. And you want to impose a boundary condition, say at a finite location, you want to impose some condition, say here. But since you don't know A, I mean, you know at which location you are, but since you don't know the amplitude, you don't know what kind of condition you want to impose there. You could also try to impose a von Neumann condition. If it falls off like 1 over R, then F prime of R is, of course, minus A over R squared. But again, you have the amplitude A in there, just saying that it should be slope here, should be minus A over R squared. You can't do that. But what you can do is impose a condition between the function and the derivative to ensure that it has the right fall-off behavior. And the idea is that you combine these two terms in such a way that the amplitude A cancels. And that's a condition that you can then impose. And the way to do that is F of R plus R times F prime of R. If you take this combination of these two functions, then of course you know, you see that if you multiply this by R, you get minus 1 over R, 1 over A over R, so that the A actually cancels. So if you impose this condition, that is called a Romain boundary condition for fixed R. That's a mixed boundary condition between Dirichlet and von Neumann, and then it forces a 1 over R fall off. And this is the condition I want to impose at my boundary here, simply because it is something that's more complicated, but it also looks more rightish. So if you want to solve for, say, gravitational potential or electric potential, and you expect things to have a 1 over R fall off at large radii, then this is a nice approximation domain if you are looking for solution only in a finite subdomain, because you don't want to go to infinity, but you still want to capture the idea of a 1 over R fall off. And this is what is implemented here with the 1 over R fall off. So this Robin function takes its inputs, the value of the function f at the boundary, the derivative of f at the boundary, and the location of the boundary. And this is just what I just wrote on the blackboard, except here I call it x instead of r, f plus x df. And I'm modifying the boundary conditions here like this. And you see it's now a linear combination of f and f prime. And if you ask Mathematica to solve, oh no, actually let me also switch back to the exponential function, to the Gaussian in my equation, so that Mathematica can give a reasonable solution. You can ask Mathematica to solve that, and the solution looks now like this. Look at the scale of the y-axis. It's actually minus 1/2. And if this was a 1 over R falloff, well, in one dimension, it won't be a 1 over R falloff, right? In one dimension, it's going to be linear. But in three dimensions, you can imagine that the function then would continue and would hit the x-axis at infinity. And we can continue that with our analytic solution. Or the numeric solution. Yes?
Can you say one more time why there's not? Because in one dimension, you don't see the 1 over R falloff.
That is a property of the Laplace operator. 1 over R is a solution of the Laplace operator. Wait, does that make sense? Okay, in three dimensions, if you have a 1 over R, that is a solution of the Laplace operator, if you exclude the origin, where 1 over R is not defined. And in one dimension, that is not the case. Or is it? No, I'm having a blackboard moment. Sorry, yes. No, in one dimension, it's only constant functions and linear functions that you get. It's not 1 over R.
So
we could, of course, solve that in three dimensions as well. Yes?
So what harm would it do to solve this by explicitly setting expressions to zero, or by using these solved directly?
oh, if dsolve works, you can do it. Okay. It's perfectly fine. And if it doesn't work, maybe you can tweak it. But if you have a partial differential equations in several variables, for example, you have a complex differential operator in three dimensions, and unlike the Laplace operator, you don't know how to separate it in variables. Or maybe if you do know, you don't know how to solve it. Maybe you don't, I mean, maybe it's more complicated, you can't use the Bessel functions in the radial direction. In this case, you need to use an approximate solution. If dsolve can solve it, then you're very happy, and
saying,
then it's fine.
What I'm saying is in the implementation of your code, instead of having things set to zero, mapping like the...
Oh, why not say equals zero? Yes, this is, I need that here, for example, in the numerical method, where I have the boundary conditions, and I make replacements, and so on. And then I want to expand the boundary conditions, again, in terms of a polynomial basis that I chose. And I can expand a term, but I can't expand an equation. That doesn't make sense. So this is the only reason. So it's this last step where you get rid of the x dependence here. This is the one that where this wouldn't work. Of course, you could, at this point, remove the equal sign, expand, and put the equal sign back. I just chose to do it the other way around. Boundary conditions, and looks slightly different now. And let me plot the solution that you get with these new boundary conditions. Oh, you see Mathematica is still calculating, huh? So these black markers indicated that Mathematica was still busy. And this is the solution that Mathematica gets here. Let me also run through the piecewise polynomial ansatz for this. I'm hoping for a particular difference that I can show you. For these boundary conditions. It's not very visible. Okay, sorry, give me another minute. I'll try one more thing. Okay, now you see it. I reduced the accuracy for the numerical method by using the piecewise polynomial ansatz. And you now see that these solutions that I'm getting from the piecewise polynomial ansatz and from the other methods, they seem very different. But this is just an apparent difference. The difference is because the slope here at the boundary is slightly different, and the boundary conditions just looks at the slope at the boundary and the function value at the boundary. And then it adjusts for that. And that means this yellow function is just shifted up compared to the other solutions. But this is not actually, I mean, it looks very different, but the error is not actually very large. It is just a tiny difference at the boundary that leads to this difference. If you were to continue the solution, say in three dimensions, you would still go to 1 over r very nicely. But there's still this large offset. So you have to be aware of that, that if there's a slight error in boundary conditions, in particular, if you have mixed boundary conditions, that can lead to a large offset in the solution. If you have this second order differential equation. Okay. Okay. I still have trouble reading you whether this is all clear or whether this is boring. So I think I want to defer to this afternoon where you can have the notebook and where you can look at things, and then we will see whether it makes sense or whether it doesn't make sense. But without more feedback from you, I think it doesn't make sense for me to continue and explain further details where I know whether this goes over your head or whether I'm just filling you with trivialities. Do you have questions to what we discussed this morning? Okay, that's very bad, no questions. I apologize. Next time you get the notebook ahead of time, and then we can go through it together, and maybe at a slower speed. Thank you.